Welcome to the New Books Network.
Tēnā koutou e te whānau. Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your favorite host, Adam On, for the podcast New Books in Australia and New Zealand Studies. As always, my focus today is Aotearoa New Zealand. I hope everybody is doing well, navigating through the pandemic. Today is a very good day because today we talk to Ross Kalman, who is the editor and translator of the book He Puka Puka Tātaku I ngā mahi a te Rauparaha Nui, a record of the life of the great Te Rauparaha, which is written by his son, Tamihana Te Rauparaha. Welcome, Ross.
Kia ora, Ed. Ai, tēnā koutou I ngā kaiwhakarongo.
So, Ross, just for the interest of our listeners, can you tell us about your background in terms of an author and a writer?
Yeah, sure. I suppose, yeah, books have always been a very important thing for me from childhood. I always wanted to be an author when I grew up. And, yeah, I read voraciously. And, yeah, when I was growing up, actually, I didn't really know about my Māori whakapapa, so I knew that I was Māori, but I didn't actually even know what tribe I was, who my ancestors were, and so on. It wasn't until I was about 18, actually, that I started to develop a real hunger to find out about all this sort of thing. And so I started spending time with my grandmother, who was still alive back then. We're talking about like the early 1990s. And, found out I was Ngāti Toa, and descended from a guy that a lot of people may have heard of, especially in this country, Te Rauparaha, who's, you know, one of the most, I guess, famous Māori chiefs from traditional times, from the, you know, the 19th century when Europeans first came to Aotearoa. That sort of set me off on a journey that sort of approximately 30 years later has led to me putting out this book. So, yeah, it's been a huge journey of discovering about myself, my own personal identity, as well as learning the story of my ancestor, Te Rauparaha. Mm.
So, as Tamihana did several times in the book, let's take the narrative back to how did you come about finding the manuscript?
Yeah, right. So it's interesting. So obviously I'd learnt that I was a descendant of Te Rauparaha, and so suddenly I was very interested in anything to do with Te Rauparaha. And at that point there was a biography out by Patricia Burns, and I was familiar with that had come out in about 1980. But yeah, I was actually studying at the University of Canterbury, and I was just browsing the shelves of the library, as I would do sometimes. It was amazing the coming across that university library for the first time, just shelves and shelves and shelves of books, lots of like dusty tomes, real stereotypical kind of dusty tomes that you imagine no one's picked up for 50 years, that sort of thing. And I kind of imagined to myself that the manuscript, which I did pick up, was one of those that probably not many people had looked at. What I found was the University of Canterbury Library has got a complete set of the George Grey Māori manuscripts. So George Grey, obviously, is a big figure in New Zealand history, was a significant collector of Māori manuscripts and other manuscripts as well, not just Māori. He also has a big, old Bibles and religious texts and so on. The university's got a full, bound photocopies of all his Māori manuscripts, including one that, well, I picked up that said, Life of Te Rauparaha, Tamihana Te Rauparaha, and it was, I opened up that manuscript and, was amazed to see page after page of beautiful handwriting in Te Reo Māori, a language I didn't really know at that time. I'd only just started learning, so, I could look at the page and I'd hardly recognise any of the words. but I just felt that it was written by his son who actually knew him. So his son, Tami Hana, was born around the early 1820s. So he kind of spent a lot of time with his father. And when his father died, Tami Hana was about in his late 20s. So he had time to engage with him, develop a relationship as a child and also as an adult. And, yeah, luckily for us and luckily for his descendants in particular, he was also a real, into his writing, wrote lots of letters. And he also, wrote down the story of his father's life sometime in the 1860s, as it turned out. Yeah.
Mm. Mm. So it's very interesting. I've read a few other biographies before. Recently, I read Te Whiti o Rongomai's by Danny Keenan, and they are very good. But while reading Tami Hana's work here, it felt so personal. It felt so personal to me. So in terms of starting writing the book, you've mentioned the reasons in the book, but what were the main reasons that motivated Tami Hana to write about his father?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting, when you delve into looking at the arrival of literacy amongst Māori in the, along with the missionaries. So we're talking about around about the 1820s and 1830s. As the missionaries spread through the country and introduced reading and writing to Māori. It had a massive impact on Māori in all aspects of life. The ability to read and write changed Māori culture basically fundamentally forever. Because obviously up until that point, Māori culture was completely oral. And it's funny because people now who think that a culture is oral, they sort of think that it doesn't have any depth or it doesn't have any literature, or subtlety. It can't, how can it have all that just from being in people's heads? But if you look at what we have, the different like the taonga that we have in terms of the oral culture, it's just such a rich tradition. So Tami Hana came along, and as a chief's son, he would have started off on that journey of learning that oral culture and all the history, all the stories, all the narratives about creation and all that stuff, and all the different ways, like traditional religion in terms of using different karakia, or you could almost call them spells, to achieve what you wanted, to get good conditions for your crops or to defeat your enemies in battle and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, Tami Hana, as a teenager, was introduced suddenly to Christianity and writing, and it sort of disrupted that whole thing. And so suddenly for him, it was almost like he embraced Christianity and writing and literacy with equal fervour simultaneously. And so by the time he was an adult, he'd kind of gone over to the written side of the ledger, sort of and left behind the oral. And when it came to the 1860s, at the time that he wrote this manuscript, the Māori Land Court was established by that point. So basically all Māori and across the country had to go into court to prove their own links to different pieces of land to claim ownership. And Tami Hana obviously had significant interest, being the son of a major chief. But there were gaps in his knowledge. So I believe the manuscript was his way of connecting all the dots, putting the story together. He would have known a lot of that story from his father having told him.
Yeah.
But also there would have been big blanks. So what I believe he did, and there's no real actual documentation. I've just had to kind of reconstruct what happened from looking at the manuscript closely and looking at his letters and things that we do know, and just sort of piecing it together. But what I believe happened is that he spoke with a lot of the older generation who remember those events from the 1820s and 1830s, which were crucial in terms of Ngāti Tua's claim to lands in the southern North Island and also across into the northern South Island as well.
Yeah.
Well,
it's was it anything personal around it as well to carry on the legacy of his father? At the time when Tamiana was living, times had completely changed. Just comparing the 60s to the 40s and the 30s, times had completely flipped over their head. So was there a motivation of preserving legacy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that would have been a big part of it. And as you say, that time, it was a terrible time for Māori, the early days of colonization. Basically, all their lands were rapidly stripped from them, really. And basically, a lot of them were left with not enough land to eke out a subsistence from. Tamihana, by the 1860s, he was in his mid-40s, and he probably realized he was never going to have children, which was another aspect of this document. His father's life was basically preserving this story, because that all that traditional generation of chiefs of such as Te Rau Paraha, Te Whiro Whiro, Te Huhu, a whole lot of traditional leaders who had grown up in the Māori society, they were all dying. And the Māori leadership of Tamihana's day was shifting more to the chiefs that had grown up in two worlds, and they sort of went between the worlds more often, or more easily, I should say. There was a whole mix of motivations, as you say, he was, I mean, one thing was preserving his father's good name, and that Te Rau Paraha was sometimes, or quite often, vilified in the colonial press as being kind of like, in his lifetime while he's still alive, public enemy number one in the Wellington region especially, but also after his death, Tamihana was still quick to defend his reputation when the colonial press or government made a reference to Te Rau Paraha in a derogatory way, which did happen from time to time. So there was definitely a whole mix of things going on. And, you know, that's one of the great things about history in a way, is that we actually never really know the truth. But we can, we can have a lot of fun just kind of making educated guesses about these things, speculations.
Coming to the research that you did, I was just so amazed reading the first part of the book, which is the introductions part, and the amount of detective work that you did just fascinated me. For instance, in terms of the analysis of the pictures and what was written on the pictures, that blew my mind when you found out if the 7 was 4. And I was amazed with that. I won't go into the details of how you did what you did, because it's all documented in the book. But what was your feeling like when you just, were there many eureka moments and you said, oh my God, nobody has found this and I know about this?
Oh, yeah. I tell you what, yeah, there were just so many magical moments in the journey like that where, it's like, there were so many puzzles and mysteries, little ones along the way to building up that bigger picture, to creating a good translation, and to try and to give that context and work out what little references mean and all that sort of thing. And I'm kind of like, I think I'm the right sort of personality to work out these things. I think a lot of people just give up pretty quickly, but I just like puzzling away at little problems. There were lots of things. Sometimes it was literally, like, for example, there's some transliterations, which is like English words rendered into Māori phonetically. And one of them is te kapu te rewa, which is not a Māori word at all. And I knew it was a transliteration, but I had no idea what it was. And I spent days puzzling over it and just sounding it out over and over in my head. Just to see if it would spur something in terms of just the rhythm of it would make me think of an English word. And it was through a whole lot of other research, and I literally did wake up like at 2 a.m., sit on the edge of my bed, and I thought, I actually know what this is. I know what it is, you know. It was crazy, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. The work also around the background of the use of the wer sound and the fur sound and the interchangeability of it and the way you use it to point out a time of between 4 years where it might have been written. That was quite amazing. In terms of your background research out of this, which sources did you go to? There were letters, of course. There's a lot of archival work happening. So besides documentation, did you go primary resources as well?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I made a decision quite early on that I wasn't going to look at too much secondary material, recent sources, or basically people who are quite, you know, distant from that time period, from the 1860s or even earlier. And also the other problem with those later sources is that they've drawn on poor quality interpretations of the manuscript itself, which have been out there, and I point out those in the introduction as well. I made a very deliberate decision to really focus on that generation of leaders and elders, just a bit older than Tamihana, and also down to Tamihana's age as well, their writings, their court testimony, just so that it was an authentic, I was drawing on, you know, authenticity was very important to me in the whole process. I was drawing on an authentic pool of, it's almost like having them as my reference group was these other elders of the period that I would dip into to test. Because, I mean, you can't always rely on what people write down on paper, and you know, anyone who's looked at any sort of written material, it's funny, it's written material in our, you know, in the Western culture is on a higher plane than, you know, oral, anything that's people say, which is kind of this, anything that people say has got so many negative ways of describing it, like hearsay, rumor, gossip. Whereas anything that's written down always sounds so solid, factual, rational, considered, and all that sort of stuff. But in fact, you know, I learned to be very suspicious of a lot of written sources. And even including Tamihana's, like just because he wrote something somewhere doesn't always mean it was the full story. You know, I was always thinking to myself, well, what's his motivation for saying this particular thing? And maybe is he obscuring things a bit here? And you know, so I was trying to look at other sources to sort of question what he wrote. But I also made a decision too, if someone over here said X and Tamihana says Y, I didn't want to be the one to say, oh, well, someone else is X, so Y is wrong. But I was sort of like, I was trying to support Tamihana's version, but also you know, keep that kind of questioning attitude at the same time. So it was sort of a fine line to tread. But I wanted to avoid too many multiple conflicting references because I don't think that's super helpful. I think the main thing for me was to try and draw out Tamihana's narrative so that we have that narrative now to draw on. People that are interested in this history now have a good version of his narrative.
It is extensive in nature, and it is the first book that I've read, even though I'm doing a master's. It's the first piece of literature that I've read, nonfiction, where I've read all the notes. Because usually you just ignore the notes and say it doesn't really matter because they're additional. But in this book, the notes actually enhanced your understanding of what was happening around the time that Tamihana was narrating. Do you think that it is an important part of the reading that it is essential to read the notes as well, because I found it absolutely fascinating because it expanded the nature of what Tamihana was saying.
Oh, it's really nice to get that feedback, because with the notes, like I, you know, as I was researching, I was taking copious notes. I mean, the final notes that made it into publication are perhaps 20% of what, you know, my raw notes, I guess you call them. But what I really wanted to do was to add value to the reader. That was my final criterion for keeping in notes, was I wanted to add value. And where I'd found, especially where I'd found in other primary sources a gem of information, to impart that, because I wanted to add value to the reader's experience. The other thing too, I had a lot of say, and I'm grateful to the publisher that they let me basically have my way with the layout of the book. So a lot of notes and historical and other nonfiction texts are at the back. You have end notes, and basically, only if you're really curious about something do you actually flick back to look, because it really disrupts your reading process. So I really was really keen to have them on the same page, I really went over and over and over those notes, what notes to have. The other thing I think that puts you off notes is if they're too long. Sometimes people have very long notes. I was just trying to keep them down to a succinct level. And if you really, really, really want to know about that, then, you know, obviously have the reference and you can go and, you know, if it's a land court or something, you can go and find that, you know, you can do your own reading into it. So yeah, I'm really pleased to get that feedback. And I mean, to me, you know, Tamihana wrote the text, but I wrote the notes. So that's kind of my contribution. Yeah,
it was amazing. A couple of things, for instance, because there was a lot of excursions in terms of war and attacks and defense. And just to get the picture of it, the notes really helped when you explained how the numbers worked, right? So that was fantastic. The other thing I found interesting was where you kind of took into account people's memories of what different numerous amounts of names that they've read previously. And in the notes, you will say, well, this person is related to that person. So check out 13.1 to get a revision, right? So it was one of the best things I've read. So thanks for that. So in terms of translations and preserving voice, because when you read translations, sometimes they, as you translate from one plane and the context of one language to go to another plane, kind of loses that connecting tissue. How were you able to keep that, or what were your endeavors to keep that? Because he might be speaking in anger or frustration. Because, for example, I'll give you an example. When he talked about a few times, he talked about crossing the Cook Strait, and he always said in an annoyed way, or I don't know that this is an old way of working, and today people will not really consider it, and it might be considered stupid or something. So how were you able to keep that connecting tissue that he had?
Yeah, that's interesting. And like, that's the thing. The only way I think you can start to get a feel for the nuance of their sentiment is, you know, in their writing. I mean, that's part of the thing about written language. It's like text messages or emails, and how we always misunderstand because we can't see someone writing them. Are they smiling?
Yeah.
Or are they scowling when they're writing it, you know?
Where's the irony?
Exactly. So the way I kind of over time developed a feel for his sentiment was just through constant rereading of the material. And it was sometimes only on about the fifth time I might have read a passage, I'd think to myself, oh, he's actually joking here.
Yeah.
Or, oh, this is actually, he's just making a bit of a, yeah, sometimes he's just being a bit of a smart ass. You know, yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's funny because we're so reverent of these people from the past. We think they're not really like us, but they actually just were like us. And so, yeah, getting that feel for, the sort of tone of the language, was just through repetition becoming so familiar, and you could almost start to hear his voice in your head saying the words. And that's, and then the next challenge was, of course, representing that in the English language, which... And you can't be too, you can't use a register that's too of our own times now.
Yeah.
You can't just throw in some sort of lingo that's in 5 years' time, no one will even know what it means type, you know. It's just, but at the same time, I did want to create a modern feeling narrative that wasn't couched in Victorian sort of terms, you know. If you look at a lot of Māori texts that have been translated into English, it's in that Victorian language, that sort of very stiff, formal, archaic language, and I wanted to avoid that too. So I was trying to create something that's kind of timeless, but also, as you're saying, is to try and capture the tone of voice. And that in a written text, obviously, that doesn't totally make sense, but as I say, it's kind of like familiarity with material over time meant I could actually hear it almost in my head.
So 6 years, right? How much does it consume you walking, eating, talking, tamihana? And when you finished it, was it a feeling of accomplishment, or you felt that for instance, I feel as well when I'm with a book. I recently read the Viremu Tamihana's letters, and when I finished it, I kind of felt I kind of missed him. But you actually were engrossed for 6 years in it. How were your feelings after you had finished it?
Yeah, I mean, it was all consuming at the time, and you know, I did it around paid work, so I was spending evenings working away at it, much to my wife's kind of what's the word, just over time she got a less
less tolerant
like just publish it already type of thing. So it was a labor of love, and I wasn't even doing it to make a book or to do anything in particular to start with. It was just out of pure interest. It was just like, I really want to read this manuscript. I really want to understand it. And it just developed into a translation from there. It was all consuming, but it has left a bit of a gap. So probably in the last year of those 6 years you were talking about, the last year was all pretty much full time, and I was able to get some funding to help make it a full-time project. And also having a publisher, you know, for many years I sort of thought, I might just have to self-publish this because it seemed like such a labor of love.
Yeah.
It was hard to imagine a publisher coming on board and really being sympathetic with what I was trying to do and to honor the material and so on. And I was really fortunate to meet Sam Alworthy from Auckland University Press. Absolutely, they did such a wonderful job with the production and so on. Like when I first held the book in my hands in the publisher's office, it was a very emotional moment. It was, it was hard to explain in words, but I was basically very moved by it. Just over a year ago. I'm just thinking, gee, COVID makes us have a different sense of time. Was it just over a year ago, 2021? I think it was about a year ago when the book actually came out. It's left a bit of a gap. It's left a bit of a gap, definitely. And I am keen to find something to replace that, but kind of nothing has quite measured up so far.
So let's get into what was written, the story of Te Rau Paraha within the narrative. The Tamihana has outlined the different movements of Ngāti Toa around, and it amazed me when you hear of I've read of the migration before, and you always feel that all right, they packed the bags and then they left and then they were there. And while reading it, I realized that this migration was you go, you stop, you go back, you go again, and it was a laborious work by Ngāti Toa and Te Rau Paraha. So what actually led to Te Rau Paraha to embark on such a great journey?
Yeah, it was obviously a very turbulent time. Mm. We're talking about the late 1810s and, you know, some iwi had started acquiring muskets in large numbers and using them to settle scores. And, you know, in traditional warfare, casualties were never so bad with traditional weapons and just hand-to-hand fighting. But with muskets, it's certainly the case that warfare became much more bloody. And it may not have just been about muskets. It may have been other pressures such as increasing population, especially in the north of the North Island where you've got the prime areas for growing kumara. You know, obviously the warmer parts of the country. It was a time when Ngāti Toa were constantly being harassed by Waikato, by Ngāti Maniapoto. They were all actually related, all Tainui tribes, all related. So certainly there was pressure on Ngāti Toa in their kāwhia homeland. So it's interesting, like it was quite an incredible time of long distance kind of like war parties started happening, and it was on one of these Te Rau Paraha went on along with other leaders of Ngāti Toa, as well as Ngāpuhi as well, Tamasi Wakanini, who was his great friend. They went all the way down to the Wairarapa from Kāwhia, following the coast. So it would have taken the whole trip was probably about a 12-month trip. And it's sort of a little bit hard now to know exactly what was the motivation for these trips. I mean, was it just for the sport of going? And because there was a lot of battles with the local peoples of the different regions they visited. In some cases, they would have had pre-existing alliances, so things didn't always end in battle, or else a peace could be negotiated. So Te Rau Paraha made his way down to the Wellington region.
He seemed quite impressed with the... According to Tamihana, Te Rau Paraha seemed quite impressed with Tamati Wakanene's suggestion. And it seemed to me, to my reading, that the opportunity to engage with the international traders that were coming in, Pākehā coming in, that was one of the main, one of the reasons, might be one of the reasons there as well, because that leads to my next question, that we have this general narrative in society right now that the view of Maori in the 19th century would have all been negative towards Pākehā coming in, but it was a very professional point of view towards Pākehā. Is that a valid assessment?
Well, yeah, it was quite an entrepreneurial outlook that they had, basically, what were the opportunities. Also, it required a lot of vision as well to you know, look at a Māori society, which you could say was a Stone Age or whatever society, but have the vision to realise that the European ships coming in increasing numbers was going to mean fundamental changes, and that basically, you know, were you going to sort of ignore that or just sort of jump on board and basically make the most of those new technologies at hand? And obviously the most well-known is the musket. But, you know, there was also other technologies such as iron tools for agriculture.
And transportation, I mean, it really helped with transportation as well, with some of the traveling that Te Rau Parahu did by just talking to the captain of the ship.
Oh, absolutely. That's right. You could get from A to B much quicker, and the whaling and sealing vessels, the smaller ships as well, they quickly replaced waka as the vessel of choice for making the longer journey. And obviously at that stage, water was still the best way of getting around rather than going over land. Yeah. So no, it's quite amazing to think of the vision that leaders like Te Rau Parahu had to realize the world was changing and to, basically, that's what led Ngāti Tuā to relocating to the Kapiti region, was that opportunity of interacting with European shipping and acquiring that technology. It just seemed like it was going to offer them more of a future than staying back at Kawhia, where they were going to have to be often dealing with these war parties. It seemed like it was, it's funny, isn't it? A lot of people, you know, these days move countries looking for basically better opportunities, and it's a very similar proposition, really.
It's the time that has been mentioned by Tamiana across the story, with my reading, it felt like the temperament of Te Rau Parahu was changing through time. So as it came to Hauwhenua time, he seemed to be not really happy with what was going on. He lent his mana and he worked with them, but he seemed to be providing a lot of choices to everyone that, okay, you want to do it, so you do it this way, but I will do it this way. And also it was more of a restrained, when he said to them that, you know, the Taranaki tribes are taking, plundering the food, don't engage, let them do it until physical things happen. And obviously physical things happen and war broke out. Did you feel that it kind of lent to his prowess as a military person, plus also a great leader for his own people?
Yeah, I mean, he obviously built a kind of almost like an empire, an alliance between the Taranaki iwi, Ngāti Raukawa, Ngāti Tuā. Quite a rare thing in traditional Māori society, actually, to have a multi-iwi identity or entity that by working together they were able to, you know, overcome a whole lot of other, build almost like an empire across Raukawa, Moana, Cook Strait. But, you know, when you read the manuscript, you realise what a fragile entity it was, because, you know, the nature of Māori society was that, not just at an iwi level, more of a hapu or sub-tribe level, each sub-tribe and the leaders of that sub-tribe have their own autonomy, which you can't take away from them. So basically you could never, Te Rau Parahu was never like a king or an emperor. You couldn't just decree something and people would do it. There was always negotiation, discussion, and as you say, you know, he was, by the time of Hauwhenua, which was a very bloody, messy, kind of like civil war situation in the around about 1834. By that time, you know, he was just giving advice to other people rather than telling them what to do. So yeah, it was, it's kind of like gives you a real insight in how Māori society operated at that point. And, you know, a lot of later observers have come along and go, oh, if, you know, if Māori had all banded together, they could have kept Pākehā out of the country, or, you know, things like, and things like that. But really that's very unlikely in the Māori sense, and that, you know, groups would come together for short, short-term situations, but unlikely. The nature of the society, the very nature of society, meant they wouldn't do that for over a long period of time.
In terms of the mention of the haka, kamate, it, I mean, people living nowadays would say that, oh, it should maybe make the one of the bigger parts of his narrative, but the time at to my understanding, the time at that time was different. I mean, there was no All Blacks at that time, so and some of the other events are mentioned less as well, like the Wairau part with Rangihata, and so why do you think these later events were mentioned with lesser detail as compared to the previous events before the 30s?
Yeah, I mean, it's yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the haka. Obviously, today, with, you know, All Blacks being a global phenomenon, everyone knows about kamate, and that's probably the thing that Te Rauparaha is most famous for today. Quite possibly, it wasn't actually a big deal in his own lifetime. And that Tamihana, if it was a big deal, Tamihana would certainly have focused on it. I think it's grown in momentum, and probably largely through the endeavours of Ngāti Tuwhare Toa, the iwi who's kind of like the hosted Te Rauparaha when he composed that haka. You know, it's interesting that in this, in Tamihana's manuscript, there's a number of haka and traditional waiata mentioned, but not kamate. So he, as you mentioned, he does focus on the events, I guess, pre about 1840. And there isn't that much about kind of, interactions with, say, Governor Grey in the 1840s, all that sort of stuff. I believe that it was really probably, you know, and you mentioned Hau Whenua, the sort of civil war kind of situation. It was really up until that Hau Whenua that his, I suppose, Tamihana considered his greatest deeds were achieved. By migrating, and then by bringing that alliance of three iwi together, and then by creating a kind of like an empire. That was really the pinnacle of his achievement. I think from Hau Whenua onwards, it became a little bit more fragmented, and then obviously you had the arrival of, you know, the New Zealand Company, and so on, and Te Rauparaha was obviously still considered to be the leading chief in the Rokawa Moana Cook Strait region in 1840. But yeah, by that time, you know, he was perhaps 70 years old by that point, so he did a very long life. And so, I mean, it's only natural people slow down a bit, you know, as they head towards retirement.
That's understandable. And I mean, his mana was maintained through time, even by that time as well, because George Grey was worried. And he had to illegally kidnap him and move him around in a ship all around. So there were elements of understanding in the New Zealand government at that time that, all right, if we want to get our ways forward, I mean, this person needs to be shut out. Just talking about that, I couldn't understand it. I couldn't decipher it from the book. Why did the relationship of Tamihana develop in a positive way towards George Grey later in life?
I know, it's a great mystery, isn't it? You know, Tamihana, he had this thing for European authority figures. He kind of really looked up to them, basically. And the first one he really came in contact with was Octavius Headfield, Bishop Headfield. Then we have the first Bishop of New Zealand, George Selwyn, who, yeah, I mean, and then not long after that, Tamihana met George Grey. And all these figures Tamihana kind of idolizes. He's like a real, I don't know what the word is, like a Westernophile, you know, he's a real one of those people that just loved everything to do with the West. English culture, thought it was the pinnacle of culture. So I suppose in a way he kind of believed the hype of those early earlier colonial, you know, figures. He believed the hype that basically the English culture was superior and that, you know, Māori should just forget about their old ways and adopt this new culture. So, yeah, George Grey was certainly almost like a godlike figure. Well, you know, Māori thought of their leaders and leaders like George Grey as almost being pretty close to divinity, basically. So he was almost a godlike figure. And so even though he actually abducted his father illegally without any constitutional basis, Tamihana obviously didn't really hold it against him. And I think Tarapiraha probably helped Tamihana's acceptance of it too, because Tarapiraha could kind of see that maybe it would almost certainly avoid bloodshed. Him being kidnapped meant that it did avoid Ngāti Toa and other iwi rising in greater numbers against the government and what they were doing at that time, so that you had just Te Rangi Haiata and some other smaller element who were more active in active resistance. And so relatively speaking, in terms of, you know, in the 1840s, in terms of the Wellington region, there wasn't much loss of life and so on and warfare.
Yes, so that's very interesting. And he had a very different life track as compared to his father. It's mentioned in the book as well that he didn't care about the danger that might exist going to the South Island to preach Christianity, and he just went there. So he did have a different idea of life for himself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. As I said, he loved all things English, and he even self-funded a trip to England in the early 1850s at considerable expense to himself. He just wanted to soak it all up, learn as much as he could about Western technologies. He wanted to see where all this material and technological know-how, where it all came from. He wanted to go to the source. And he pretty much remained for the rest of his life very pro-government and was often a mediator in disputes, kept the peace between Māori and Pākehā, and between Māori and Māori as well. Very interesting figure in his own right, but very operated in a totally different world to his father.
Well, I have, before we close up, I have an interesting thing to talk to you about. In one of the pictures you mentioned, it's a bit of a mysterious thing. It's Tamihana and his wife. Let me open it. And it actually says, the caption says that Tamihana te rauparaha, Rawako Ruta te rauparaha, kua mate I tō horo maketu. Tamihana te rauparaha and Ruta te rauparaha died at te horo maketu. And I found it, I mean, you dealt with it in the book as well. With the modern context in mind, I found it very romantic, in the sense that, I mean, that was their home, that was their area, and he just wrote that, I mean, she's gone, so, you know, we both are gone. I don't know, I just wanted to get your point of view on that, because I looked at it from a very romantic point of view. I didn't feel like it was a mistake, but it seems very deliberate. There's the writing doesn't seem to be rubbed on, or nothing has happened to it. What was your point of view around it?
Oh, yeah, that's a funny one. That's just one of those things, and it's almost like, almost like it would be a bit sad if I was able to solve all the mysteries. Like,
yeah,
there's something, there's something nice about just
the mystery.
Knowing, knowing that some things are going to confound us, and we'll never really know. Hmm. That one. It's just, as I say in the book, I don't quite know what Tommy Hunter was talking about. it's a funny thing, you know, I still kind of hold out some hope that one day perhaps someone will tap me on the shoulder and say, hey, you know that in the book, I know what that's about, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Someone might tap me on the shoulder. I might find out. In a way, I kind of like these mysteries too.
We come close to our times. I've made so many notes, and I really wanted to go into a lot of detail, but then we'll reveal all the secrets. People need to buy the book, right? So I really found it fascinating, and it was an excellent piece of editing, translation, and the introduction part and the notes all together created a great picture of Teropara. Actually, in the recent games when All Blacks played Wales, and I saw the haka and I felt so much joy. I was like, I know almost everything that is out there about the person who wrote it through his son's words, and it kind of becomes a bit more important and meaningful as a representation of New Zealand abroad. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's great. Well, maybe, he was a prolific letter writer. Maybe that's another book. You never know.
You know, I have thought about that. I think his letters would make a nice book too.
So what's... what's coming up? We always do that as a customary thing in the New Books Network. So what's next in terms of writing or projects coming up?
Yeah, so actually recently I've had another book come out. It's called He Atua He Tangata, The World of Māori Mythology. So it's like a...
Oh, I saw that. You're a part of it.
Yeah, so I'm like the editor. And it's a collection, you know, if you're interested in the Māori worldview, it's a really good introduction to Māori thought in terms of from creation through the stories of, you know, demigods like Maui and Tawhaki through to more recent narratives. I had that one come out not too long ago, and I've got another Māori picture dictionary. Again, I'm just like a co-author. That's also coming up. In terms of like a really meaty book project like this one, I'm sort of in between, and I'm kind of just mulling things over, just so that, you know, as you can appreciate, if you to spend 6 years on something, it has to be the right thing. It can't just be anything, you know.
Yeah, you need to bring your brain down to a base level to get it started again. Yeah, that's quite understandable.
But yeah, like what you're saying, your suggestion about the letters is actually something I have thought about. It would be a very interesting insight to those times. And I feel too that point of view of someone who was more pro-government, it's like a less sexy kind of point of view. You know, a lot of books have been put out about people that resisted colonization. Yeah. I think this point of view is equally interesting in its own way, as you suggest, it could actually make a really nice book too. Yeah,
I mean, it can be. I found his view as in quite nuanced, because from other sources that I've been reading, he was against some of the things that the government were doing a lot of the times. He was not really happy with the land courts and how things were going. So, it can be a very nuanced point of view coming out of the letters as well. Thanks, Ross, for taking time on a wonderful day today to talk to us. It was a fantastic chat, and most definitely the listeners would find it really enjoyable. Thanks for joining.
Thanks, Ed. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Yep. So to... to end this for everyone, I'll read one of the quotes, which is at the back of the book by Tami Hana. It is, Kaore kau he kaumatua hei rite mo te raupata, te rau paraha te mohio ki te whaiwhai me te toa hoki, me te tino tangata ki te atawhai tangata. There has never been a man equal to te rau paraha in terms of knowledge of warfare and prowess in battle and in being so dedicated to looking after people. Nō reira, tēnā koutou katoa. Bye, everyone.